Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Once again, we are our guest is John Burns with John Burns Consulting Services in Orange County. John, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
We had just begun off-air talking a little bit about FHA, and how important do you view that FHA program for the health of, let's say, the real estate industry over the next couple of years?
You know, if the mortgage liquidity from FHA had not kicked in 06, 07, 08, there would have been no 80% plus loan-to-value loans made. And I think we would have seen home prices fall another 10 to 15%.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, and I'm being kind.
and you know what's interesting on this market, let's say California has a $340,000 median price right now. When we were going up the last time, you know, when we were coming off the 97 and headed up and we got to 340, the maximum loan in Riverside County for FHA at that time was 160 grand when we had a 340 median price. Now the maximum FHA loan is 500 grand.
Right.
And that is very supportive of the market. But yet I bet they're writing the safest paper they've ever written as well.
I've had conversations with them about that. Their 2010 and 11 and 12 books are performing really well. They're getting the highest insurance premiums ever. Even though they haven't changed their policies that much, the banks have voluntarily not made loans to the guys that are sub 600.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. They're going to earn their way out of this.
Yeah. But what's interesting is when you're trying to make policy decisions, a lot of times people are stuck in 2005 and 6 and 7 and start saying, okay, well, down payments, I mean, if they're not 20%, that's a big problem, which is Dodd-Frank's idea.
Yeah, Sheila Bair has been a big proponent of that. And sure, Sheila, 20%, you know, 80% LTVs to people with $100,000 incomes and 28% debt-to-income ratios are safe loans. I agree with you. But we can't just roll to that overnight. That would kill housing.
Well, you know what's interesting? If you ever look at a chart of performance of a portfolio of loans, whatever it is, you know what the safest loan is over, let's say, the last 50 years? It's a VA no-down borrower. So when charts tell me that that statement is completely wrong, you know, it sounds reasonable, though, and I even know the quote, you know, where, of course, when somebody puts 20% down, they've got a big stake in the property and all that. And then you look at a chart and it says, well, you know what? You couldn't tell the foreclosure difference up until, you know, this last ridiculous downturn where all the loans were, you know, stated income and stuff. Prior to that segment, prior to, say, 2000 from what, 1950 on, you would not be able to tell the foreclosure rate from any program. They were all within an eighth of a percent.
Right.
So, you know, to make a national change that's that radical for no reason, that's just, it's amazing that it sort of gained momentum and it's still, I mean, that's still up for grabs, right?
Well, I think it's a real minority movement. I don't think that's consensus. I mean, the one thing that I think is consensus in Washington, D.C. is nobody wants to see the housing market collapse on both sides.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, so I think whatever comes out of that Dodd-Frank when we get the qualified mortgage and qualified residential mortgage, I think is going to be relatively reasonable. What's absurd is that it's taken them more than 2 years to define what that is. There's so much lobbying going on, it's unbelievable. I think the banks are just saying, tell us the rules and we'll play by them.
Yeah, and I know they've had input on the rules, and I know that's been asked by, you know, by Congress a number of times. Do you feel that Congress has a depth of understanding sufficient to make the correct decision?
No, but I feel that the professionals in D.C. do. So the folks at Fannie and Freddie and FHA and Treasury and Fed, all the ones I've met with are very smart people that have studied the issues and know these things. And they, you know, they hear the lobbyists too, but they hear what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. And you know, for the most part, most of the decisions that have been made in D.C. during the downturn have been pretty wise, honestly.
You know, I agree with that. We've really weathered this completely ridiculous 5-year period. Not nearly as bad as it could have been. That's absolutely true. What kind of mood are the builders in for, say, 2013? What do they expect to happen?
Well, if you're a publicly traded home builder, you're euphoric because your stock is up 150%.
Yeah. Now, is that getting ahead of itself, or is that?
Well, it's totally ahead of itself.
Okay.
I have a number of clients that have been buying the builders, and what they tell me is, like, look at what other industry can we count on that's going to double in volume and being able to raise prices over the next several years? There's not many.
No, that's true.
And it's almost like a safe harbor investment for them. And sure, it may go down and I may be way ahead of myself, but I think at some point these guys will justify the current share price. And it's tough for them to pick other industries where they can feel as confident.
Where are the stock price? I have no idea on the answer to this one. 2000, let's say where the peak was, whatever it was, 05, 06, and now. I mean, they're not remotely close to the peak of before, right?
No, I don't even think they're halfway back.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Okay. So where do you feel the market will be a year from now as far as, and then I don't know what price structure you're going to, you know, mention, because there's median price and a Case-Shiller price, but, you know, real price movement. Do you feel that we'll have positive movement in California? And do you feel that there's any price segment that still could be under pressure?
Under pressure, up or down?
Either, I guess. But I was in that frame, I was thinking, is there any residual downward pressure for any price range just because of financing being tough to get?
Yeah, no, I don't see any residual pressure downward at all. You know, unless we have some sort of sequestration and we have job losses, then I think you can see a number of markets take a dip. And there are some pretty heavy defense markets like Colorado Springs that aren't doing as well right now. I think that's one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got our own price index because there's not enough of them out there, right? but ours is, I think, I'll quote ours. When I rolled up all the markets that we forecast, it's at a 5% growth for next year.
Okay.
And 6% the year after that. I compared it to the 113 economists that Shiller used to survey. I think Zillow took that over from them, and we're the fifth most bullish. But as you and I were discussing earlier, you can build a case that it could be a lot more than that if the economy continues to grow and mortgage rates stay low.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'll even go further than that. I think this is one of those unique. You do need the interest rates to stay low, but I don't think you need anything to be created job wise. And it's only because we foreclosed on so many people that if even 80% of those people have jobs, the quantity overwhelms the supply.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, I mean, what are we doing at 1 month's supply? I mean, whatever policies we've created has gone taken the inventory from 6 to 1 month. And I don't see any policy that's going to kick it back up to 6 months. So you have maybe 6 to 8 months demand trying to buy 1 month of inventory.
Yeah, and that's in California.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah, that's in California. And I guess that's usually the problem in a way, is when you're trying to create national policies, you probably have 45 states going, what are they talking about?
Right. Particularly when you talk about the $500,000 cap on mortgage interest deduction, there's 45 states that don't even care.
Yeah, it's like, well, you bring up another point, too, because I think they're sort of looking for, okay, where can we get the low-hanging fruit? You know, let's get some chips here. Real estate seems to have a few targets, and the one that I think I never got in the first place is sell your house every 2 years and make $500,000 free. And first of all, you have to be in the right state for that. That probably isn't even possible, but more than a few. And you'd think, that's a lot of money. Do you think that's, is that being under discussion to say, no, let's forget that? I haven't heard much about that.
I don't think so, because I don't think it's that, you know, the money that they're playing with, I don't think it's that significant.
Okay.
I mean, to give you an example, if they cut the mortgage interest deduction from $1 million down to $500,000, that only raises $5 billion a year for the IRS, and they've got a $1 trillion problem. So,
okay.
So I would imagine that that tax thing is even less.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
Well, then losing the mortgage deduction becomes more, or it becomes less likely then, because it's not such a great revenue generator?
Yeah. So what the lobbyist that I'm paying most attention to is telling, well, not the, I guess the lobbyist, is that what seems to be most discussed in D.C. is putting some sort of cap on all your deductions, either 25 grand or 35 grand. That's going to be the way that it seems like they're leaning towards taxing the rich, if you will.
Does that include charitable?
That does not include charitable.
Okay. Because that would be a real problem.
Yeah. No, I don't think they're going to stick it to the charities.
Okay. AMT, that's an interesting problem. Because that's, just for fun, I looked over the last 3 years' tax returns, and I've paid 40 grand in AMT tax. And that's just sort of, it's like, okay, it's over and above what the chart proves, but for some reason you're just, you know, you're getting too many goodies, so here's your tax bill.
Yeah. Well, that's a good problem to have, Bruce.
I guess
good
so.
For you.
But you know what I think? I think that, you know, they're talking about if they don't make some of those changes, that a lot more millions of people will start having a tax bill they've never seen before.
Yeah. You know, and it'll have much more of an impact in California, too, because somebody that makes $150,000 a year in Arkansas is incredibly affluent and doing great. But a two-income couple in coastal California, that's an entry-level buyer.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do these national numbers fairly, if you will.
What about Prop 13? I mean, we had an election that was pretty well dominated, and does that change the outcome for Prop 13? Can it now get voted out?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. If that were to change, do you think that would have a very negative impact?
Well, I mean, if they go to, we're going to assess your property and pay you, you're going to pay 1% or more of that, that would be a huge negative impact on older people that have lived in their home for 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
Fixed incomes.
Yeah, that's...
So, but I can't, if they did that, I'm betting they exempt those folks. And the real benefit of going to property taxes, theoretically, is to keep a more stable income base. But, heck, our home prices go up and down so much, I'm not sure property taxes are stable either.
We had a pretty well-known economist on the radio show within about 6 months talking about Prop 13. And he was a big proponent of it changing and taxing those people. And I brought up the older people that would probably not be able to afford their taxes and have to leave their home. He said that's what reverse mortgages are for. I thought, wow, I can't believe you just said that.
Yeah.
So, no. Yeah, that's not very sensitive, but maybe that's how some people think. I don't know.
That's not how the majority thinks, though. I
wouldn't think so. I think that'd be pretty politically the third rail. You shouldn't do that one.
Well, if you're going to bring these folks up, the most amazing thing to me about this election is the lack of voice in seniors. Because the ones that are really getting... penalized with these low interest rates are savers.
That's right.
People in their 60s and 70s who thought that they would have 5% interest income per year for the rest of their lives, and they're getting 0.5%. Totally,
yeah.
Not. And they never spoke up. Who's speaking for them?
Yeah, and that's a game changer, because then you take risk of principal, because you're now being aggressive on
that's
return.
Right. You got to go buy junk bonds and do all these other things just to get a 7% return.
Right. There was Cal Poly Pomona had a demographer come in, and he was talking about how radically different construction would be in the future. And he's talking about, people living in high rise communities in California where, you know, like you see maybe underway in Irvine. Is that a true statement, or do you think that people always prefer to live in their single family home?
You can't generalize, and Molly Carmichael leads all our consumer research, so I'll try and summarize it as best I can. I think there will be a growing percentage of boomers who want to live in some sort of high-rise as a retirement style. So I think you'll see some growth there. I think the younger generation values their time more than their parents did, so they're going to be less likely to spend 2 or 3 hours a day on the road to have a backyard, more willing to sacrifice, you know, and have a small yard, and the amenities are being with your friends and close to things and around your family. So I do see that sort of a trend. I don't see the young folks in high rises because especially they're expensive.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe the more affluent ones will do it, but I've read some of that, and I don't know if this was this particular guy out of Utah or not, but he was essentially saying that the single-family lot in California was totally dead.
Yeah, that must have been the guy. It couldn't be two people with that opinion, I think. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I barely could keep my mouth shut as I was listening to him, because I was sitting next to him before he got up, and then he came up with all this stuff, and I was just, wow. But, you know, that's interesting. I mean, a very smart guy with a PhD certainly believes he's saying the truth because he's out there. But I just, you know, didn't say.
No, so a PhD doesn't mean you know what you're talking about.
I guess, yeah, I certainly have disagreed with my share of them, so.
You've been right.
You know, demographics, though, I mean, that is something that plays a big role in the next 20 years. And so when a builder is looking to build something, is he really looking at maybe we've built all the 3,000 and 4,000 square foot homes we need, and now we're going to concentrate on some other segment?
Yeah, you know, I should backtrack a little bit on that high-rise comment, particularly in coastal California, where we are seeing a lot of affluent foreigners move in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you come from a lot of these countries where maybe it's not as safe to live, the affluent people live in high-rises for safety, and that's they're more accustomed to those types of living. So I should have pointed out I do think there's some demand there. And now you bring up the demographics. It's not just the U.S. having children and growing. There is a lot of immigration that's coming here from all over the world. Despite our problems, I think people still believe that the United States is one of the best places to live in the world because it's safe and our schools are better than theirs and the medical system is good and everything else. So I'm pretty bullish on immigration, and that's where the builders have been spending a lot of time now because they've been noticing that, hey, we're designing these homes for people like me when the builders themselves tend to be very white.
Mm-hmm.
And we're selling homes to people from completely different cultures and we really don't understand them.
I remember you mentioning some builder in Utah not quite understanding the lay of the land up there and being surprised. And
right.
Then you're saying the same thing. You might have multi-generational housing more often in Hispanic culture, let's say.
Oh, yeah. Now, the U.S. culture is weird that you don't want to live with your parents. Around the rest of the world, people do. And actually, if you bring that up, Lennar primarily has been a leader in this. They've trademarked something called next-gen housing, where they're building some homes that are really designed for two sets of adults living in the home together, but having the kind of privacy you might want, like your own garage entry and even your own little mini kitchen area when you want to seal off from the rest of the house.
Sort of like a duplex, a quasi-duplex.
It's a quasi-duplex, but you can't get a you can't.
Yeah, it's
call
not
it
an
duplex.
R2 lot. That's right, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a zoning challenge, but if you look in the neighborhoods today, you know, how many people are living with their parents? Whether it's a 25-year-old living with mom and dad or an 80-year-old living with their children.
What's interesting about what you just said is I think that's sort of like shadow household formation, because you probably have a lot of those instances where that's an economically driven decision, not necessarily a lifetime preference. And as soon as jobs created and all that, you'll probably have a lot of households emerge from the back bedroom, and maybe they're not being calculated.
Well, you're right, but what is interesting, there's been a fair amount of research done, is the baby boomer, the badge of honor was to get the heck out of the house.
Right.
The echo boomer seems to like their parents more and vice versa. So there's an economic reason, but there's also kind of a, you know, hey, this is a good situation for a higher percentage than the prior generation, if you will.
Well, they definitely, and, you know, just because I have to pay attention to it when I do stuff, I would think, I remember the marriage age for the echo boom generation being something like 26 and 28. you know, for male, female, and very different than my even my generation. It was low 20s. So they are hanging, and I think that's what demographers sometimes look at is say, okay, well, they want to be very mobile and they want to be able to move where the job market is. And then I think they find, you know, oops, I'm going to get married. And then all of a sudden they become just as stable as everybody else.
And what's surprising to me is that the mobility has actually trended down.
Yep.
But when we did the research on it, what has trended up? Two incomes. So it's not as easy to pack up and move to Dallas when there's two of you that need to go.
Ah, that makes sense. Now, are there, it seems to be that single owners would probably represent a pretty healthy percentage of a marketplace.
They are. It's a huge growing trend, and mostly single women.
Okay. And these are credit capable, but probably, again, getting back to a saying, okay, what do we build? That would be a person that wouldn't want necessarily a 3,000 square foot house.
No. One of my clients, they're now gone after the downturn, but it was Portrait Homes, specialized in affordable paired townhomes and targeted at singles, primarily single women, and they would find places where like a new hospital was going in or a university was expanding, and these people were college educated, and they would, that was their target market, and they did great. They just expanded too fast.
I'm just curious, so the of the builders that went through the last 5 or 6 years, did the national builders survive better than the local ones?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Well, I should say the public builders survived.
That's what I meant, public, yeah.
The private builders, because they had a different debt structure. So private builders have a construction loan on every single asset, and almost every single asset had distress, and you had to deal with the bank. The public builders tended to have big bond offerings that may not be due for 4 or 5 years with no lien on the asset.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't being called to the carpet by the bank. And then the federal government completely, they had a lot of bailout programs, not necessarily intended at the builders, but they totally benefited the builders, allowing them to go back and recapture taxes paid over the last 20 years, put hundreds of millions of dollars on each of their balance sheets. And then when interest rates fell, it allowed them to go to the, it opened up the debt markets and allowed them to go get low cost debt and stick their maturities out for 10, 12 years.
Okay.
So it was a different debt structure really saved the public builders.
That's interesting. That makes a lot of sense. Do you think that one of the things that we'll do in the next 4 years is sort of do somewhat like a Reagan immigration forgiveness year and say, you know, welcome into the fold somehow?
You know, what would be the most brilliant thing to do is what Canada does. That is, if you've got some sort of a net worth, let them in. Because those people are not criminals. They don't take jobs. They start companies.
Right.
And they invest locally. And I believe that would be a good business policy for the United States to allow affluent immigrants easier access to the United States.
Do you, we've got about a minute left. Fannie, Freddie, 5 years from now, do you think they're going to be radically changed? Or?
Well, I think it'd be foolish to radically change them. First of all, they're back making money too, and mm-hmm. they owe us a lot of money, so why not let them pay us back?
Right.
They were set up in the 1930s to provide mortgage liquidity in a crisis, and they did that this time. You certainly would not want to get rid of the ability to have mortgage liquidity in a crisis. And they're very efficient at the securitization process, which keeps everybody's interest rates down. They were mandated by Congress to go get more aggressive making high-risk loans in 04, 05, 06, 07, and the CEOs at the time and the senior management were able to line their pockets by doing so. Put those controls in place that'll never happen again, and I think they should be fine. I think politically, though, they may need to be called something else, and maybe they'll break them up the way they broke up AT&T, but I think the structure is going to exist.
We're out of time. That's a perfect way to end the show. John, thank you so much for joining us once again.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.